behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bolin.
Ben, we're back with our part two of the most obscure cars list that we're covering.
The wait is over, and thank you in advance to everybody who has sent us some emails regarding this.
Thanks for hanging in.
Going to go ahead and tell you that not everything you guys said made the list here. We've got our story. We're sticking to it. But we're going to revisit some stuff, too.
Yeah, we're going to continue following the original article that we started out with here, the Jalopnik article from Matt Hardegree. And, you know, these were written in by Jalopnik listeners who said, you know, I know 10 of these vehicles. And then I don't know if you listened to the first one or not, but we've added quite a bit of information to what was reported in the article here.
So, yeah, some background.
You can follow along and see photos and get some of the basic stuff. But we went a little bit deeper on this just to add our own little flavor to it.
Yeah, and I've got some strong contenders for most obscure car because I'm not sure if I agree with the order of these.
Yeah, I mean, I think we could all probably juggle these around a little bit and say, like, no way, that one should be number one for sure. But in true top 10 form, we've been going from 10 through 1, and we wrapped up with number 6 last time, which was that that crazy
P1900, the Volvo P1900.
Yeah, the Volvo P1900 that really never was, I guess, thankfully. And we're going to pick it up with number 5 on the list, which is a, man, I kind of wish this one was built. I mean, for real.
Yeah, it's a much stronger entry. We're talking about the 1963 ATS 2500 GT, the 3-liter coupe.
That's a long name, Ben.
Oh, yeah, its friends call it the ATS 2500 GT.
That's what we'll call it then, because, you know, this ATS coupe or this ATS vehicle, it was actually, ATS is the name of the company.
Right.
That built this thing, and this has its own unique story as well. Now, let's tell you just a little bit about the vehicle before we tell you really what ATS is. The vehicle itself is a 220 horsepower mid-engine 2.5 liter V8. That was able to hit 150 miles per hour. Now that's pretty significant. It sounds like a really cool car, right?
Right.
I mean, looking at the photo, it looks like a really, really nice coupe design. It's really, really attractive design, I guess.
Yeah.
And this ATS company that built it, that's where the real story comes in, because they only built less than 10 cars, and only one of these cars actually had a full interior in it.
Right. We're talking about here we go. Forgive me, Italians. Automobili Turismo e Sport in Bologna.
Very nice, Ben.
Really? Well, that's kind of you.
And I think that the only maybe like really significant thing that we need to tell you about this one before we move on to our next one. I mean, just take a look at the photo. And, if you ever see one of these, consider yourself lucky because, you know, again, less than 10 built, only one with a full interior. But where this thing comes from is so fascinating to me.
Yep.
It comes from an important time in history. It comes from like a significant event that happened at Ferrari. And it was after something that was called the Great Walkout in 1961. And if you don't know about the Great Walkout at Ferrari,
we should just do an episode on it too.
We probably should. I mean, these things kind of lead to other episodes for us. So again, look up the Great Walkout in 1961 about Ferrari. It's almost the end of Ferrari as a car company.
Yeah. And, the folks at ATS who, well, we could say just a little bit without being too spoilery. The folks at ATS, one of their missions later in their company's lifespan was just to beat Ferrari. It was so personal. We have to go on with that.
And I mean, look at that car. That car is a Ferrari fighter, I guess, if you want to call it that, really.
It's a Ferrari killer.
I mean, think about 1963 and that vehicle. That's a well-advanced design that comes from people that clearly were on the inside at Ferrari. I mean, it's definitely a solid vehicle. I really wish that one was produced. You know, there were at least, you know, let's say 20, 25 of these things instead of less than 10, especially only one with a real working interior.
Right. Oh, man.
It's too bad. I think the chances of really actually seeing one of these are very, very slim.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing, though, I'm sorry I keep adding stuff here. They did have a competition version that came out that had slightly higher horsepower. It's 245 horsepower.
Not bad.
Yeah, but it didn't do well.
Okay.
Anyway, let's talk about something that did do pretty well, or that has a lot of fans.
Yeah, a huge amount of fans.
Yeah.
I mean, a giant underground following. I don't even know if you could say underground, like cult following, maybe?
A cult classic, the 1984 1987 Honda CRX Roadster.
And yeah, one of the reasons that this particular vehicle, the Roadster, has such a small group of people that were interested in it even, is because that it takes a vehicle that was already small and a two-seater, and like I said, I couldn't even keep it when I had a family, really.
Right, yeah.
It makes it even less useful in some way because now there's a convertible top they have to deal with, and it doesn't have the hard top because,
right.
I'll be honest, my hatchback, I could put anything inside that Honda CRX hatchback. I fit ridiculous things inside there. Bicycles standing up inside
there.
Yeah,
and those hatchbacks were all over the place in the 80s.
They were, and they, you know what? You can still spot them around. People still love them.
Yeah.
There's still, you know, kind of this cult following of them. But the Roadsters, now this is an unusual story because I think it was 1984 to 1987, a company called, Straman.
Straman.
Yeah, that's probably the best way. Straman Coachworks.
Yeah.
And this is the company that was like the original customizer that decided that they were going to create, convertible or ragtop CRX vehicles.
Yep.
And that's exactly what they did. Now, I think there's a typo in the article that we're reading here. Jalopnik article. Because I read somewhere else that they created a total of 310 of these things. And this article says 130.
But I saw the same thing. I'm pretty sure it's 300.
I think it's 310 because I saw it other places. I went to several different articles to look up the information to see if I saw the 130 again or the 310.
Yeah.
And I found 310 in several different places. If you want to go read about the CRX Roadsters, which I guess are still around, you can still find people driving these things, you can go to the Honda Tuning Magazine article that is called 1985 Straman Convertible Honda CRX, or I think the slang for it is just Ragtop Rex is what they call it.
Yeah. You can also check out some interesting discussions about it on various forums.
Yeah, because other people did this. You know, other people, you know, there were one-offs that, you know, people would do it on their own, you know, in their own garage or whatever, and that's fine. But then there were other companies that also did this, but they followed Straman. In that, you know, Straman was the first one to do it, or Straman, or whoever you want to say.
Yeah, kind of a harbinger.
Yeah, they were the very first ones to do it, and they only built 310, but I guess they paid, you could get one through the Honda dealership for something like $5,000 more than you would pay for your straight Honda CRX.
Right.
I guess it was a coupe or a hatchback, really.
Yeah.
Hatchback. And $5,000 at the time, I mean, think about $5,000 in 1984. I mean, I don't have the conversion on hand here, but that was a significant amount of money. I think that's about all I paid for mine total, $5,000, when I bought it used. You know, mine was a 1990. I bought it a couple years used, and I think it was around five or six or something like that, you know, total. So I can't imagine adding this on 10 years prior to that. It would have been a significant amount of money.
Yeah, and which kind of explains why there are so few. We've got to go to something that I'm excited about this. I think you might be excited about this too. A little bit of preface. Scott, I want to spend a little bit more than average time on this car because we have so many listeners in Canada and, you've written to us and said, "Hey guys, enjoy the show. More Canadian cars." Well, we're starting to dip our toe in it with this one, number three, the 1971 Matic GT.
You're making me want to sing the Canadian national anthem, Ben.
Oh, hey, take a shot.
No, I'm not going to do it.
I'll clap in the background.
Oh, Canada.
No, I'm not going to do it. Not the whole thing, anyways. It's just the beginning.
Okay, well,
I'm not going to. I hear it at every hockey game I go to, so I pretty much know the whole thing.
Oh, yeah, people might not know. Scott Benjamin, you're a hockey fan.
Are you a hockey fan?
My family has a lot of hockey. I saw some growing up, but I haven't gone out to games recently.
All right, maybe we'll have to change
that. I mean,
that.
You guys, if you know, we're based in Atlanta, and Atlanta has terrible luck with hockey teams.
Yeah, we're not big into hockey, but we do have I don't know what you call it, a farm league, something like that.
Yeah,
not far outside of town here, the Gwinnett Gladiators.
And, uh-huh.
I go to their games often.
That's cool.
Yeah, they're excellent play. It's almost like watching the pros.
I didn't know that. We should go sometime.
Yeah, definitely should. But anyways, back to the vehicles, right? So the 1971 Manic GT, and the name Manic, now it sounds like a cool name for a car anyways. It's
right,
a Manic
yeah.
vehicle, right? But it's named for Quebec's Manicouagan River. Is that right?
Oh, man.
I think it's Manicouagan.
Yeah.
And hydroelectric project. So it's named for a river in Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
And it was built by a guy that worked for Renault.
Yes. And he's a Montrealer. Now, you've got his name down here, right? We talked about this.
Yeah. Now this name, this is a funny name. If you read it in, like here in the United States, if you read it, you would say Jacques About. But I'm guessing, I'm going to guess that because this is a Canadian name and you know how they say about. They say it About.
So Jacques About.
I think it's a Jacques About is this guy's name. So Jacques About
Jacques
is the guy that worked in the late 1960s for Renault. And I guess he was, what was his position there, Ben?
Oh, he was in their PR department, weirdly enough.
PR department. Now, see, I would have guessed this guy to be an engineer or, you know, some type of machinist or something like that because of what we find out later.
Right.
But I guess what got him really fired up about this whole thing was that Renault wanted him to create this this feasibility study of bringing the Renault Alpine vehicle to Canada. And if you know about the Renault Alpine vehicle, that was a sports car, a competition car that was being sold in Europe at the time. And the Alpine was a you know, a rally contender. It was a it won several rallies. I mean, it was a significant contender in all these events.
Popular in Europe at the time. And also apparently the study that he conducted showed that Canadian consumers – would also very much love an Alpine.
Yeah, so he's got this result of the study that says, yeah, this is a great vehicle. We'd love to bring it here. However, Renault decides, I don't think we're going to do it. You know, we had to do the study, but and we know it would be a popular vehicle here in Canada, but I don't think we're going to bring the Alpine to Canada at this time.
Yeah.
Let's just put it on the back burner for now. And he's thinking, well, the time is right. Let's strike while the iron's hot, right?
Yeah, he really believed in this study, you guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Believed in it so much that he said, okay, you don't want to import the Alpine. I'm going to go make my own company and make my own car.
Yeah. Based on a Renault.
Based on a Renault.
Yeah. Of course. Cause that's what he knew. You know, he knew that, you know, Renault had the right platform to use, right? So, so he builds this car based on a Renault platform. He has a rear engine, rear wheel drive vehicle. It's a 1.3 liter overhead valves, four cylinder engine. And I think there were 4 and 5 speed manual transmission options available. And he had 3 separate tuning variants that were available as well. You could get one with 65 horsepower, one with 80 horsepower, and then I guess the top dog was the one with 105 horsepower. And it's and it's a small car.
Right.
So it's probably very powerful. Of course, the rear engine, you know, that setup is you know, really good for weight distribution. People love driving those things. You know, it's a lot of fun to do that.
Yeah.
And you know, again, based on a working Renault at the time, so you know, he knew that this setup would really work. Well, just a few years later, he had to decide, you know, once he gets the prototype going and
right.
he gets all of his ducks in a row for, you know, how we're going to build this vehicle and what it's going to, you know, be completely made up of, you know, all the parts and suppliers and everything, the whole line. I'm going to need to raise some money in order to get this thing going. So he raises $1.5 million in capital. And again, this is the late 1960s, I believe.
Yeah, it turns out that he is phenomenally good at raising money.
Yeah, I guess. And he has the backing of the snowmobile manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Bombardier? Is that how you say that? We always struggle with this one.
Yeah, we are not French.
Bombardier? I always say Bombardier, but
Bombardier.
It's Bombardier, I think,
Bombardier.
Is the snowmobile maker.
And then some supermarkets got behind him.
Yes.
Or one supermarket.
Steinberg Supermarkets. They got behind him as well. And I think the Canadian government and Quebec even, you know, said, hey, why don't you build it? Because this is something that's going to bring jobs into our community.
Yeah, it was really set to be, as they mention in this article, by Jalopnik, the first big Canadian sports car. However, and I know some people will argue about that, but when we say big, we mean super, super enormous, ubiquitous on the road. Mm-hmm. However, they ran into what ultimately sank them, which was, as you mentioned before, Scott, a supply chain issue.
Yeah, they had trouble getting the Renault parts shipped into Canada reliably. So they were having, you know, they're actually in production, and this is really what we call the first Canadian built car.
I mean,
this vehicle is the first Canadian built car. So the Manic GT is, you know, has its part in history, but they couldn't get the parts into Canada reliably enough to build cars continuously. So the total number of production vehicles that were ever built of these Manic GTs were something like 160 vehicles. And, you know, the number originally planned was supposed to be something like 2,000 per year. So, you know, significantly under what they had projected, I guess, for even 1 year of production is what they ended up with, 160 vehicles. I mean, that's really, really small.
Which is a shame because it sounds like a good car.
It really does. And, you know, the rear engine design, all that had it going for it. It wasn't intended to be a I guess a sports car racer vehicle. It wasn't intended to compete on the track or anything. It was just right. intended to be a good road-going car with good performance and good fuel economy.
That you could use as a daily driver.
Exactly. And I think this guy had the right idea. And it's a great-looking car. It's a pretty cool design, especially for 1971. I mean, think about what was out there in 1971. Look at that design.
Yeah.
That matches a lot of what we find from, you know, the British sports cars of the day. I mean, it looks exactly like that. Mm-hmm. So, solid design. I'm upset that this one didn't actually make it longer. I mean, all these are the same way, but then again, they wouldn't be on our list.
Well, you know, also we could do a great story about early Canadian cars because of the other ones that I remember. I know that, they had some tough luck for a while.
Do you really think we could do an entire podcast on early Canadian cars?
Maybe we'd have to do Canadian cars from a certain time span to the modern day or something.
I hadn't really thought about it, Ben, but I guess maybe we could.
We could. Well, listeners, let us know what we should cover. But while you're thinking what we should cover, you know what? You guys go ahead and talk amongst yourselves because I have a question for Scott. Okay, Scott, while everybody's figuring out which Canadian cars we should cover, just between you and me, man, I can't take the radio anymore.
Really?
The radio is driving me nuts.
Too many commercials?
Scott, my friend, we have finally arrived at the top two of this list.
Yeah, the top two.
Top two.
Top two. And number two is one that I'll be willing to bet that not many people have ever seen one of these in person.
No.
A 1956 Powell Sport Wagon. And, man, these are unusual, Ben. And there's a great story that goes along with them as well. I don't know if you dug into the background or not.
The whole Plymouth thing?
Yeah, the Plymouth thing. I dug in just a bit on this. And what really makes – and just reading from the article here, it says what makes it awesome is that this – it's a Plymouth-based sedan – or based wagon, rather, that was built on a 1941 Plymouth chassis, engine, interior, all that stuff. It was just a rebodied vehicle, I guess.
Yeah.
And they call it a kind of a crossover SUV vehicle. And this is, again, going back to 1956. Very unusual thing. And it had these exterior panels that were all, pretty much slab side type panels. They've got some curves in them, but they didn't do anything complex at all because the reason given here is that curves were expensive to do.
Right.
And
yeah.
It's a very, very affordable vehicle. And I'll tell you some of the prices as we get towards the end here, but, what these guys did, now these two brothers, and I think, what was their names? Hang on one second, I'll find it here into my notes. I want to say it's like Hayward and Channing Powell were the names of these brothers. And they were from Compton, California. And what they would do is they would go to junkyards and they would find old 1941 Plymouth chassis to buy. And they would buy the chassis for something like $45. That was all they paid for them. $45. And they would have them shipped to their Compton, California factory, their plant, and they would rebody these things. And, you know, they kind of refurbished the chassis and the engine a little bit. You know, sometimes they'd refurbish the engine. I guess that was one of the areas that they were a little gray on it. You know, a lot of these junkyard cars leaked a lot of oil. They burned a lot of oil.
Yeah.
You know, they had some problems, but, you're getting kind of a refurbished vehicle, I guess, for your money.
Sure.
And so these rebodied vehicles, they built them in wagon form. They built them in truck form. So you could get a pickup truck or a wagon. And the photo I'm looking at here is of the wagon. And it's a beautiful example. I mean, it's a very well-restored vehicle. If it wasn't, you know, original, I think it may have been restored. But the sheet metal bodies were of their own design. It was something they came up with.
Yeah.
And they used steel for the bodies. They used fiberglass for the front ends. They used chrome from old Ford pickups, I think was what they used for the for the chrome on the things.
Yeah.
Not just pickups, but just chrome from any old Ford. And sometimes they had wooden bumpers, but sometimes they had steel bumpers. It kind of depended on the vehicle and what they had
available.
Yeah, what they had available at the time.
Yeah.
And they built 1,000 pickups, Ben, and 300 wagons. And that sounds like a lot, but when in the grand scheme of things, you know, 1,000 pickups from 1956, that's really a drop in the bucket.
I was going to say a drop in an ocean.
Yeah, they're rare to find. I mean, if at all, if you're going to be able to spot one at all. And this wagon that we see here, you know, this is a show vehicle that they take around, obviously a restored vehicle.
Yeah.
But it's really, really cool looking. I mean, and it's got some unusual features to it as well. Or one in particular that everybody likes to point out.
Oh, I think I know which one you're talking about. The fishing line holders, right?
Yeah.
Those fishing pole holders.
Yeah. Those tube things.
Yeah. So they have these tubes in the rear of the vehicle and they are, specifically designed to hold, I don't know, like dowel rods and fishing lines.
I think the initial intent was to hold a fishing pole. I mean, that was the whole goal of this thing. So you know that these are long, long tubes, but they completely fold, not fold, but they completely slide into the body of the vehicle from the back end. Like almost picture where a tail lens would be. It just unscrews with a handle. And then you pull out this tube, and it looks like a piece of, I think it's furnace ductwork that they used to create this thing. It was ingenious design, really. I mean,
they
really
like fishing,
smart.
I guess.
They must really
but
have liked fishing.
Also, I don't know why it was so hard for me to say fishing pole. I guess it just got caught on saying fishing line.
No, that's all right. That's slang for fishing pole sometimes. So these things were, and you could get that design in both the truck and the wagon. And I think they only included it on one side, but the prototype vehicle, if you ever see the prototype of the pole of the Powell sport wagon, you'll see that it has the canisters, those long tube canisters on both sides.
Right.
I think they dropped it on one side for production because, you know, it was a little cheaper to do it that way.
That asymmetry bothers me, though.
I guess. Now, the price.
Yeah.
The price, and I read this somewhere, it said that they were under $130.
What?
But I have a hard time believing that because not much later by, you know, that was 1952 when they started building these. And they said that, you know, $130 was about the price of one of these brand new refurbished vehicles.
That's crazy.
But by 1956, the price had risen up to $1,095, which, I mean, let's be honest here, raising up to $1,095, that's still not a whole lot of money. I know in 1956 it was probably significant, but that's not a lot of money. And that was for the sport wagon. And if you wanted to go up to what they called the deluxe sport wagon, that was $1,198. So it added about $100 if you wanted to go up to the deluxe, whatever that got you.
Yeah.
And then I think they offered a camper edition as well, like a camper that you could add onto the back of the, maybe the pickup truck.
See, the thing is, if they could have just had more access to parts, because again, this is what, the third vehicle in our list that gets shorted because of supply issues.
And the crazy thing is, and I find this unbelievable, they've already built 1,000 pickups and 300 wagons, and they're using these 1941 Plymouths.
Yep.
I guess when they ran out of Plymouths to find, because they scoured every junkyard all across the United States, and they ran out of vehicles to find and to build on, they were so focused on that 1941 Plymouth design that they couldn't adapt. They couldn't go anywhere else with it. They said, well, we're out of vehicles. We have no more supply.
That's all, folks.
I guess. And you know, if you want to read a little more in depth about this, there was an article at the there's a Chrysler site called Allpar. And if you go to Allpar and search for the Powell Sport Wagon, you're going to find a pretty good write-up and some good photos of these things. You know, the original prototype design and, you know, some of the workings of those tubes that they had that slid in and out of the back. Strange, strange design. But that was really cool. I wish, again, I keep saying this, but I wish there were more of these out there, but then they wouldn't be on our list, would they?
Yeah, but if they kept going, they could have so much stuff. They could have custom designed fishing poles that come with the vehicle. People love things like that.
A whole marketing angle,
you know. And let's see, speaking of great segues, it's time, I think, for us to finally discuss number one. Noel. Noel is our super producer here. Hey, Noel, could we have a like really dramatic drum roll?
Coming in at number one on the list is the 1963 to 1967 Gordon Keeble.
Yeah, and we've probably got some people right now who are saying, Gordon Keebler? Like the cookies? No, it's Keeble.
You mean like the
Alan R.
Like the elves?
Yeah. And it is, we assure you, a car. It's not just any car. It's a very interesting and pretty good car.
Yeah, no kidding. This one, there's a lot to this one, a lot more than you would think just having a quick cursory look at it, because this one is fitted with a 5.4-liter V8 from a Corvette. And when you look at this thing, it looks like, a typical British sports car, I guess, of the era, which is not bad to begin with. I mean, it looks like a James Bond car almost, a bit like an Aston Martin in some way, at least in the photo that
I'm
looking
at. It's very British.
Very, very British. That's probably a good way to say it, Ben. And, boy, it went through several different engine variations, but the way the car came about was this guy named John Gordon. And John Gordon worked for a car company called Peerless. And the Peerless car company, I think they were having some financial troubles at the time. They were struggling, you know, they were having a little bit of difficulty. But Gordon kind of broke off from there. John Gordon did. And he eventually teamed up with a guy named Jim Keeble. And together they built this car called the Gordon GT. Now, that's the original vehicle, not what we're talking about right now. But the Gordon GT was built on a Peerless chassis, because, of course, you know, that's what he knew, just like the guy with the Canadian vehicle, and he knew the Renault chassis, right?
Yeah.
So he builds this one on a Peerless chassis with a Buick 3.5-liter V8, so it's a strong vehicle. And then later they fitted the same vehicle with a 4.6-liter Chevy V8, so they went up a little bit in power. And then after they well, there's a story behind this, but they eventually went up to the 5.4-liter V8, which, you know, as we know, that's what they ended up with, I guess, for the Gordon Keebler. But
right,
the car was shown at the Bertone stand, and I always struggle with this one again. Bertone stand in 1960 at the Geneva Motor Show.
Right,
and it was, you know, the Bertone is like the kind of the one-off builder, I guess, of Italian automobiles, right?
Right, and they had built this in less than a month. Yeah. They built this.
27 days is all it took to build this vehicle. So after, you know, it did pretty well at the show. You know, the Geneva Motor Show in 1960, it created quite a splash, I guess, with the media and with the public. And after some road testing, and the car was finally shipped to Detroit, where then kind of the Chevrolet management gave it a once over.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what the deal was behind this, but, you know, they knew that they were using their engines in the product. And I think the idea was that, you know, John Gordon and Jim Keebler, wanted to somehow get some kind of deal going with Chevrolet in order to provide drivetrain for this thing.
Right. So that they wouldn't get lost without any supply chain.
Exactly. And so the Chevrolet management, you know, after they looked at the thing, said, yeah, it's definitely a go. We're going to give you Chevy VH, you know, the Corvette V8s mm-hmm. in particular.
Yeah.
And gearboxes to go into production with this thing. And they built about 90 vehicles to start with. And I think that they found out that, you know, it was just too expensive at the time. The price is just too steep to continue because people weren't buying them. I don't think that they were popular
right.
With the car buying public. Is the problem.
Yeah, unfortunately. And there's a weird marketing thing with this. When you check out some photos of this vehicle, which you really should because it is worth your time, you'll see that they have an emblem that is a little bit counterintuitive. You guys, they have a pet tortoise on their cars.
Yeah.
And the reason they have this, this turtle there, or excuse me, I know there's a difference. The reason they have this tortoise on there is because, when they were taking the photo shoot, right, for their company photo, somebody's pet tortoise wandered into the shot.
How did that happen?
It photobombed. Well, maybe it took a lot longer for them to get the camera set up.
It's taken a significant amount of time.
Yeah.
For a tortoise to wander into the shot.
Right, which is not known for speed.
So doesn't get much slower than that.
So they loved it. Apparently it was a funny day.
Yeah, but this car, I mean, this car, that's an interesting story behind the logo. That's funny. But, this thing has 300 horsepower.
Yep.
You know, not a huge vehicle. I mean, it's a pretty small car. I mean, take a look at the photo, you know, any photo, look up Gordon Keeble 1967. You'll see a shot of this thing. It turns out that exactly 100 of these were built because the final examples, I guess, were built from spares. At the end of production in 1967. So while they built 90 at the factory that were built and sold, I think 10 more were eventually put together. And I think 90 of them still are around.
And they tried to restart it again in 1968 because a guy named John DeBrun, an American, a Yankee, bought the rights to the car, but he didn't really do anything. There were two more cars that were pretty much Gordon Keeble, but they had a DeBrun's badge on them.
I see. And you know what? The main thing that was holding this one back was price. Because I mentioned that the price is a little bit too steep. And I did the breakdown on this thing and I converted it to current dollars if you'd like to hear it. And this is kind of the wrap up of the whole thing.
Because it was what, 2,798 pounds?
Can I tell you one more thing before I tell you the price?
Yeah.
This is maybe another interesting little thing.
Oh.
The interior of this thing.
What? Oh, wait. Okay,
maybe you have something else even. Uh-huh. But the interior of this thing is said to have what they call an old luxury jet feel, which to me, that sounds so awesome. Imagine like a 1960s luxury jet.
Yeah.
And that's what the interior of this vehicle feels like when you get inside of it. It has, things like toggle switches and quilted aircraft PVC and, you know, black gauges. It's, you know, like white on black gauges. It's supposedly like a really, really interesting looking interior, and it probably just feels right when you get inside. It's just one of those cars that just feels right. You know?
Weird. You know, another thing, I thought you were going to say something different, which is officially my weird thing. It has two gas tanks, my friend.
Two gas tanks. Oh, that's like the old trucks or maybe conversion vans or something like that.
Isn't that weird?
That's kind of cool. A reserve tank.
All right. What's the scratch?
Back to price. Yeah, back to the scratch. All right. So what held this thing back, Ben?
Yes, sir.
We're back to price again. Is that, you know, the price was just too steep in 1960. Now, the price initially was 2,798 British pounds in 1960.
Okay.
And I couldn't do the conversion between, you know, what that was back then, you know, what that equated to U.S. dollars.
Okay.
So I couldn't figure out the U.S. dollar amount then. That was
1960 pound to 1960 cash.
But what I could do, Ben, is I could take the 2,798 pounds in 1960 and extrapolate it to 2013 dollars. And that's what I did.
Okay.
So 2,798 pounds in 1960 is equal to 46,517 pounds in 2013.
Oh, no.
So the dollar amount, the U.S. dollar amount.
Oh, man.
$77,055 in 2013.
Oh.
So that's a pretty significant amount of money. Now, I don't know what the 1960 direct conversion was, but you're looking at, you know, if it were to come on the market right now, this is a vehicle that would cost $77,055.
Cool.
And, you know, in pounds, 46,517 pounds. If you wanted to do it that way.
That's a lot of mozzarella.
So that is, Ben. That's a lot of money.
Yeah. I guess I see why a lot of people didn't buy it. So that is number one. And as you said, and I'll say it this time, there's a reason these cars get on these lists.
Yeah. And we've said this before, but I don't know if I'd put that at number one. I might sway towards, something really unusual like that Opera Coupe or something that we'd covered.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. For obscurity, what I'm thinking is first off in terms of just raw numbers, mm-hmm. you know, I want something that was either meant for production and didn't make it or just had a smaller number.
I mean, this is number one and there were 100 produced and there are 90 of them out there somewhere.
Right.
But still, I've never seen a Gordon Keeble on the road.
Yeah. I think we'll have to make it a mission to find one. I think our chances of running into one randomly are quite low.
Pretty slim.
Yeah. I have a favor to ask you.
What's that?
Can I just read some laundry list names of companies that people might consider obscure?
I would love that.
Okay, great. I want to do this in lieu of listener mail as a bit of an experiment. So we're just going to read this list. And Scott, you tell me if there's something that you think we should do a podcast on. Listeners, do the same. Are you ready?
Ready.
All right. Artiga, Ascari, Breckland, Capero. I'm watching you as I'm reading these, see if you're into any of these. Caterham, Covini, Devon, Donkervoot, which I did not make up, Elfin, which I think we have mentioned Elfin once or twice, FM Auto, Farbio, Fisker, Gumpert, and that's it.
I think about six of those. I was keeping track of my hands here. I think six of those I would have an interest in doing a full episode on.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, and you know what? The other ones, I'm sure that they've got pretty unusual vehicles as well. I mean, who knows? Maybe they could be in their own podcast together, you know, grouped together as one.
Yeah.
But all of those are definitely unique brands. I mean,
were you thinking of Covini?
I don't know.
Was that was on
the list? No, I don't know. Now that's one that could be dumped in with the others, I think.
Yeah.
But there's some interesting ones there that I would like to cover in a full podcast for sure.
Ah, okay.
And I bet listeners have their own list as well.
Ah, yes, which brings us to our most important point. Guys, if you've already checked out our excellent website, carstuffshow.com, you know that we have a great interest in all sorts of vehicles, especially if we haven't heard much about them before. So check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Let us know which obscure cars you think should have been on the list. Let us know your favorites. Let us know if you drive a little known vehicle or have personal experience.
That would be interesting. I love it when somebody says, I personally own one of these and here's, you know, a few photos of it and some of the unusual things about it.
Yeah. And those almost always end up turning into some fascinating personal stories too about how you got the car, what happened with it, your adventures in it. So go ahead and tell us what you think. Now, you don't have to write just about obscure cars. If you have an idea for something we should cover in the future, we want to hear that too. I'll read limericks. I don't know if you will, Scott.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah. Depends. Dirty limericks?
I did not know there were clean limericks.
We're a family show.
We're a family show. We won't read them on the air, but we'll probably read them.
We would still appreciate them.
We'll appreciate them for their artistic merit. So that's it. Just drop us a line. Our email address, as always, is
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.